By the end of the first semester, I'm close to failing all my classes, except English. I show a strange aptitude for literature, especially poetry. Memorizing famous poems, writing original poems, it comes easily to me. We are assigned to write a short verse about our daily lives, and I set mine proudly on the teacher's desk. She likes it. She reads it aloud in class. Some of the other kids later ask me to ghostwrite their homework. I dash off their assignments on the bus, no problem. The English teacher detains me after class and says I have a real talent. I smile. It's different from being told by Nick that I have talent. This feels like something I'd like to pursue. For a moment, I imagine what it would be like to do something besides playing tennis, something I choose. Then I go to my next class, math, and the dream dies in a cloud of algebra formulae. I'm not cut out to be a scholar. The math teacher's voice sounds as if it's coming from miles away. The next class, French, is worse. I'm très stupide. I transfer to Spanish, where I'm muy estúpido. Spanish, I think, might actually shorten my life. The boredom, the confusion, might cause me to expire in my chair. They will find me one day in my seat, muerto. Gradually, school goes from being hard to being physically harmful. The anxiety of boarding the bus, the 26-minute ride, the inevitable confrontation with Mrs. G or Doc G actually make me ill. What I dread most is the moment, the daily moment, when I'm exposed as a loser, an academic loser. So great is this dread that over time Bradenton Academy modifies my view of the Bolitari Academy. I look forward to all those drills and even the high-pressure tournaments because at least I'm not at school. Thanks to one particularly big tournament, I miss a major history test at Bradenton Academy, a test I was sure to fail. I celebrate this dodging of a bullet by eviscerating my opponents. But when I return to school, my teacher says I have to take a makeup. The injustice. I skulk down to the office for the makeup test. Along the way, I duck into a dark corner and prepare a cheat sheet, which I stash in my pocket. There is only one other student in the office, a red-haired girl with a fat, sweaty face. She doesn't blink. Doesn't register my presence in any way. She seems to be in a coma. I fill out the test, fast, copying from my cheat sheet. Suddenly, I feel a pair of eyes on me. I look up, and the red-haired girl is out of her coma, staring. She closes her book and strolls out. Quickly, I shove the cheat sheet into the crotch of my underwear. I tear another sheet of paper from my notebook and, imitating a girlish handwriting, I write, "I think you're cute. Give me a call." I shove the paper in my front pocket just as Mrs. G storms in.
"Pencil down," she says.
"What's up, Mrs. G?"
"Are you cheating?"
"On what? This? If I were going to cheat on something, it wouldn't be this. I've got this history stuff down cold. Valley Forge, Paul Revere, piece of cake."
"Empty your pockets."
I lay out a few coins, a pack of gum, the note from my imaginary admirer. Mrs. G picks up the note and reads under her breath. I say, "I'm thinking about what I should write back. Any ideas?" She scowls, walks out. I pass the test and chalk it up as a moral victory. My English teacher is my only advocate. She's also the daughter of Mrs. G and Doc G, so she pleads with her parents that I'm smarter than my grades and my behavior indicate. She even arranges an IQ test, and the results confirm her opinion.
"Andre," she says, "you need to apply yourself. Prove to Mrs. G that you're not who she thinks you are."
I tell her that I am applying myself, that I'm doing as well as I can under the circumstances, but I'm tired all the time from playing tennis and distracted by the pressure of tournaments and so-called challenges. Especially the challenges. Once a month, we play someone above us in the pecking order.
I'd like any teacher to explain how you're supposed to concentrate on conjugating verbs or solving for X when you're steeling yourself for a five-set brawl with some punk from Orlando that afternoon. I don't tell her everything, because I can't. I'd feel like a sissy talking about my fear of school, the countless times I sit in class drenched in sweat. I can't tell her about my trouble concentrating, my horror of being called on, how this horror sometimes morphs into an air bubble in my lower intestine, which grows and grows until I need to run to the bathroom. Between classes, I'm often locked in a toilet stall. Then there's the social anxiety, the doomed effort to fit in. At Bradenton Academy, fitting in takes money. Most of the kids are fashion plates, whereas I have 3 pairs of jeans, 5 t-shirts, 2 pairs of tennis shoes, and 1 cotton crew neck with gray and black squares. In class, rather than thinking about the scarlet letter, I'm thinking about how many days per week I can get away with wearing my sweater, worrying about what I'll do when the weather gets warm. The worse I do in school, the more I rebel. I drink, I smoke pot, I act like an ass. I'm dimly aware of the inverse ratio between my grades and my rebellion, but I don't dwell on it. I prefer Nick's theory. He says I don't do well in school because I have a hard-on for the world. It might be the only thing he's ever said about me that's halfway accurate. He typically describes me as a cocky showboater who seeks the limelight. Even my father knows me better than that. My general demeanor does feel like a hard-on. Violent, involuntary, unstoppable, and so I accept it as I accept the many changes in my body. Finally, when my grades hit bottom, my rebellion reaches the breaking point. I walk into a hair salon in the Bradenton Mall and tell the stylist to give me a mohawk, razor the sides, shave them to the scalp, and leave just 1 thick strip of spiked hair down the middle. "Are you sure, kid?" I want it high, and I want it spiky, then dye it pink. He works his shearer back and forth for 8 minutes. Then he says, "All done," and spins me around in the chair. I look in the mirror. The earring was good. This is better. I can't wait to see the look on Mrs. G's face. Outside the mall, while I wait for the bus back to the Bolitari Academy, no one recognizes me. Kids I play with, kids I bunk with, they look right past me. To the casual observer, I've done something that seems like a desperate effort to stand out. But in fact, I've rendered myself, my inner self, my true self, invisible. At least, that was the idea. I fly home for Christmas, and as the plane approaches the strip, as the casinos below the canting right wing twinkle like a row of Christmas trees, the flight attendant says we're stuck in a holding pattern. Groans. "Since we know you're all itching to hit the casinos," she says, "we thought it might be fun to do a little gambling till we're clear to land. Cheers. Let's everybody take out $1 and put it in this airsick bag. Then write your seat number on your ticket stub and throw it in this other airsick bag. We'll pull out 1 ticket stub, and that person will win the jackpot." She collects everyone's dollar while another flight attendant collects the ticket stubs. Now she stands at the head of the plane and reaches in the bag. And the grand prize goes to, drum roll please, 9F. I'm 9F. I won! I stand and wave. The passengers turn and see me. More groans. Great. The kid with the pink mohawk won. The flight attendant reluctantly hands me the airsick bag full of 96 ones. I spend the rest of the flight counting and recounting them, thanking my lucky stars for this horseshoe up my ass. My father, as expected, is horrified by my hair and earring, but he refuses to blame himself or the Bolitari Academy. He won't admit that sending me away was a mistake, and he won't stand for any talk of my coming home. He simply asks if I'm a faggot. "No," I say,
then go to my room. Philly follows. He compliments my new look. Even a mohawk beats bald. I tell him about my windfall on the airplane.
Whoa! What are you going to do with all that cash?
I'm thinking about spending it on an ankle bracelet for Jamie. She's a girl who goes to school with Perry. She let me kiss her the last time I was home. But I don't know. I desperately need new clothes for school. I can't make it much farther with one gray-black sweater. I want to fit in.
Philly nods. Tough call, bro.
He doesn't ask why, if I want to fit in, I got a mohawk and an earring. He treats my dilemma as serious, my contradictions as coherent, and helps me work through the options. We decide that I should spend the money on the girlfriend, forget about the new clothes. The moment I have the anklet in my hands, however, I'm filled with regret. I picture myself back in Florida, rotating my few articles of clothing. I tell Philly, and he gives a half nod. In the morning, I open one eye and find Philly hovering over me, grinning. He's staring at my chest. I look down and find a stack of bills.
What's this?
Went out and played cards last night, bro. Hit a lucky streak. Won $600.
So, what's this?
$300. Go buy yourself some sweaters. During spring break, my father wants me to play semi-pro tournaments called satellites, which are open qualification, meaning anyone can show up and play at least one match. They're held in out-of-the-way towns, way out of the way, burgs like Monroe, Louisiana, and St. Joe, Missouri. I can't travel by myself. I'm just 14. So my father sends Philly along to chaperone me, also to play. Philly and my father still cling to the belief that he can do something with his tennis. Philly rents a beige Omni, which quickly becomes a mobile version of our bedroom back home. One side his, one side mine. We log thousands of miles, stopping only for fast food joints, tournament sites, and sleep. Our lodging is free, because in every town we stay with strangers, local families who volunteer to host players. Most of the hosts are pleasant enough, but they're overly enthusiastic about the game. It's awkward enough to stay with strangers, but it's a chore to make tennis talk over pancakes and coffee. For me, that is. Philly will talk to anyone, and I often have to nudge and pull him when it's time to go. Philly and I both feel like outlaws, living on the road, doing whatever we please. We throw fast food wrappers over our shoulders into the back seat. We listen to loud music, curse all we want, say whatever is on our minds, without fear of being corrected or ridiculed. Still, we never mention our very different goals for this trip. Philly wants only to earn one ATP point, just one, so he can know what it feels like to be ranked. I want only to avoid playing Philly, in which case I'll have to beat my beloved brother again. At the first satellite, I rout my opponent and Philly gets routed by his. Afterward, in the rental car, in the parking garage beside the stadium, Philly stares at the steering wheel, looking stunned. For some reason, this loss hurt more than the others. He balls his fist and punches the steering wheel, hard, then punches it again. He begins talking to himself, so low that I can't hear. Now he's talking louder. Now he's shouting, calling himself a born loser, hitting the steering wheel again and again. He's hammering the wheel so hard that I'm sure he's going to break a bone in his hand. I think of our father, shadowboxing the steering wheel after knocking out the trucker. Philly says, "It would be better if I broke my fucking fist. At least then it would all be over." Dad was right. I am a born loser. All at once, he stops. He looks at me and becomes resigned, calm, like our mother. He smiles. The storm has passed. The poison is gone. "I feel better," he says with a laugh and a snuffle. Driving out of the parking garage, he gives me pointers on my next opponent. Days after I return to the Bolitari Academy, I'm at the Bradenton Mall. I take a chance and place a collect call home.
Phew,
Philly answers. He sounds the way he did in the parking garage.
So, he says, we got a letter from the ATP.
Yeah?
You want to know your ranking?
I don't know. Do I?
You're number 610.
Really?
610 in the world, bro.
Which means there are only 609 people better than me in the entire world. On planet Earth, in the solar system, I'm number 610. I slap the wall of the phone booth and shout for joy. The line is silent. Then, in a kind of whisper, Philly asks, "How does it feel?" I can't believe how thoughtless I've been, shouting in Philly's ear when he must feel bitterly disappointed. I wish I could throw half of my ATP points on his chest. In a tone of supreme boredom, stifling a pretend yawn, I tell him, "You know what? It's no big deal. It's overrated."
Chapter 6.
What more can I do? Nick, Gabriel, Mrs. G, Doc G, no one seems to notice my antics anymore. I've mutilated my hair, grown my nails, including one pinky nail that's 2 inches long and painted fire engine red. I've painted my body, broken rules, busted curfew, picked fistfights, thrown tantrums, cut classes, even slipped into the girls' barracks after hours. I've consumed gallons of whiskey, often while sitting brazenly atop my bunk, and as an extra dash of audacity, I've built a pyramid from my dead soldiers, a 3-foot tower of empty Jack Daniels bottles. I chew tobacco, hardcore weed like Skoal and Kodiak, soaked in whiskey. After losses, I stick a plum-sized wad of chew inside my cheek. The bigger the loss, the bigger the wad. What rebellion is left? What new sin can I commit to show the world I'm unhappy and want to go home? Each week, the only time I'm not plotting rebellion is free hour, when I can goof off in the rec center, or Saturday night, when I can go to the Bradenton Mall and flirt with girls. That adds up to 10 hours per week that I'm happy, or at least not racking my brain to think up some new form of civil disobedience. When I'm still 14, the Bolitari Academy hires a bus and ships us upstate to a major tournament in Pensacola. The Bolitari Academy travels several times each year to tournaments like this one throughout Florida because Nick thinks they're good tests. Measuring sticks, he calls them. Florida is tennis heaven, Nick says, and if we're better than Florida's best, then we must be tops in the world. I have no trouble reaching the final in my bracket, but the other kids don't fare as well. They all get knocked out early. Thus, they're all forced to gather and watch my match. They have no choice, nowhere else to go. When I'm done, we'll get back on the bus en masse and drive the 12 hours home to the Bolitari Academy.
Take your time, the kids joke.
No one is eager to spend 12 more hours on that slow, stinky bus. For laughs, I decide to play the match in jeans. Not tennis shorts, not warm-up pants, but torn, faded, dirty dungarees. I know it won't affect the outcome. The kid I'm playing is a chump. I can beat him with one hand tied behind my back, wearing a gorilla costume. For good measure, I pencil on some eyeliner and put in my gaudiest earrings. I win the match in straight sets. The other kids cheer wildly. They award me bonus points for style. On the ride back to the Bolitari Academy, I get extra attention, slaps on the back, and attaboys. I feel at last as though I'm fitting in, becoming one of the cool kids, one of the alphas. Plus, I got the W. The next day, right after lunch, Nick calls a surprise meeting.
"Everyone gather around,"
he bellows. He directs us to a back court with bleachers. When all 200 full-time kids are settled in and quiet,
He starts pacing before us, talking about what the Boletari Academy means, how we should feel privileged to be here. He built this place from nothing, he says, and he's proud to have it bear his name. The Boletari Academy stands for excellence. The Boletari Academy stands for class. The Boletari Academy is known and respected the world over. He pauses.
Andre, would you stand up for a minute?
I stand.
All that I've just said about this place, Andre, you have violated. You have defiled this place, shamed it with your little stunt yesterday, wearing jeans and makeup and earrings during your final. Boy, I'm going to tell you something very important. If you're going to act like that, if you're going to dress like a girl, then here's what I'm going to do. In your next tournament, I'm going to have you wear a skirt. I've contacted Aless, and I've asked them to send a bunch of skirts for you, and you will wear one. Yes, sirree. Because if that's who you are, then that is how we're going to treat you.
All 200 kids are looking at me, 400 eyes fixed tight on me. Many of the kids are laughing. Nick keeps going.
Your free time, he says, is hereby revoked. Your free time is now my time. You're on detail, Mr. Agassi. Between 9 and 10, you'll clean every bathroom on the property. When the toilets are scrubbed, you'll police the grounds. If you don't like it, well, it's simple. Leave. If you're going to act like you did yesterday, we don't want you here. If you're incapable of showing that you care about this place as much as we do, bye-bye.
This last word, bye-bye, rings out, echoes across the empty courts. That's it, he says. Everyone get back to work. All the kids scurry away. I stand stock still, trying to decide what to do. I could curse out Nick. I could threaten to fight him. I could start bawling. I think of Philly, then Perry. What would they have me do? I think of my father, sent to school in girl clothes when his mother wanted to humiliate him, the day he became a fighter. There is no more time to decide. Gabriel says my punishment begins right now. For the rest of the afternoon, he says, on your knees. Weed. At dusk, relieved of my weed sack, I walk to my room. No more indecision. I know exactly what I'm going to do. I throw my clothes in a suitcase and start for the highway. The thought crosses my mind that this is Florida. Any maniac halfwit could pick me up and I'd never be heard from again. But I'd be better off with a maniac halfwit than with Nick. In my wallet, I have one credit card, which my father gave me for emergencies, and I'm thinking this is a bona fide code red. I'm headed for the airport. By this time tomorrow, I'll be sitting in Perry's bedroom telling him the story. I keep my eyes peeled for searchlights. I listen for the yelps of distant bloodhounds. I stick out my thumb. A car pulls up. I open the door, wind up to toss my suitcase in the back seat. It's Julio, the disciplinarian on Nick's staff. He says my father is on the phone back at the Boletari Academy and wants to speak to me. Now. I'd prefer the bloodhounds. I tell my father that I want to come home. I tell him what Nick has done.
You dress like a fag, my father says. Sounds like you deserved it.
I move to Plan B. Pops, I say, Nick's ruining my game. It's all about hitting from the baseline. We never work on my net game. We never work on serve and volley. My father says he'll talk to Nick about my game. He also says Nick has given his assurance that I'll only be punished for a few weeks to prove that Nick is in charge of the place. They can't have one kid flouting the rules. They need to maintain some show of discipline. In conclusion, my father says again that I'm staying. I have no choice. Click. Dial tone. Julio shuts the door. Nick takes the receiver from my hand
and says my father told him to take away my credit card. No way I'm giving up my credit card. My only means of ever getting out of here? Over my dead body. Nick tries to negotiate with me, and I suddenly realize he needs me. He sent Julio after me. He phoned my father. Now he's trying to get my credit card? He told me to leave, and when I left, he fetched me back. I called his bluff. Despite the trouble I cause, I'm apparently worth something to this guy. By day, I'm the model prisoner. I pick weeds, clean toilets, wear the proper tennis clothes. By night, I'm the masked avenger. I steal a master key to the Boletari Academy, and after everyone's asleep, I go marauding with a group of other disgruntled inmates. While I confine my vandalism to minor stuff, like throwing shaving cream bombs, my cohorts spray walls with graffiti, and on the door to Nick's office, they paint Nick the Dick. When Nick has the door repainted, they do it again. My primary cohort on these late-night sprees is Roddy Parks, the boy who beat me that long-ago day when Perry introduced himself. Then Roddy gets caught. His bunkmate drops a dime. I hear that Roddy's been expelled. So now we know what it takes to get expelled. Nick the Dick. To his credit, Roddy takes the fall. He doesn't rat out anyone. Aside from petty vandalism, my main act of insurrection is silence. I vow that, as long as I live, I'll never speak to Nick. This is my code, my religion, my new identity. This is who I am, the boy who won't speak. Nick, of course, doesn't notice. He strolls by the courts and says something to me, and I don't answer. He shrugs. But other kids see me not answer. My status rises. One reason for Nick's oblivion is that he's busy organizing a tournament, which he hopes will attract top juniors from throughout the nation. This gives me a great idea, another way to stick it to Nick. I pull aside one of his staff and mention a kid back in Vegas who'd be perfect for the tournament. He's unbelievably talented, I say. He gives me problems whenever we play.
What's his name?
Perry Rogers. It's like laying fresh bait in a Nick trap. Nick lives to discover new stars and showcase them in his tournaments. New stars generate buzz. New stars add to the aura of the Boletari Academy and bolster Nick's image as the great tennis mentor. Sure enough, days later, Perry receives a plane ticket and a personal invite to the tournament. He flies down to Florida and takes a cab to the Boletari Academy. I meet him in the compound, and we throw our arms around each other, cackling at the fast one we're pulling on Nick.
Who do I have to play?
Murphy Jensen.
Oh no, he's great.
Don't worry about it. That's not for a few days. For now, let's party. One of the many perks for kids playing in the tournament is a field trip to Busch Gardens in Tampa. On the bus to the amusement park, I bring Perry up to speed, tell him about my public humiliation, describe how miserable I am at the Boletari Academy and at Bradenton Academy. I tell him I'm close to failing. That's where I lose him. For once, he's not able to make my problems sound coherent. He loves school. He dreams of attending a fine Eastern college, then law school. I change the subject. I grill him about Jamie. Did she ask about me? How does she look? Does she wear my ankle bracelet? I tell Perry I want to send him back to Vegas with a special present for Jamie, maybe something nice from Busch Gardens.
That would be cool, he agrees.
We're not at Busch Gardens 10 minutes before Perry sees a booth filled with stuffed animals. On a high shelf sits an enormous black and white panda, its legs sticking left and right, its tiny red tongue hanging out.
Andre, you need to get Jamie that.
Well, sure, but it's not for sale. You have to win the grand prize to get that panda, and no one wins this game. It's rigged. I don't like things that are rigged. Nah, you just have to toss two rubber rings around the neck of a Coke bottle. We're athletes. We've got this. We try for half an hour, scattering rubber rings all over the booth. Not one ring comes close to lassoing a Coke bottle.
Okay, Perry says. Here's what we do. You distract the lady running the booth. I'll sneak back there and put two of these rings on the bottles.
I don't know. What if we get caught? But then I remember. It's for Jamie. Anything for Jamie. I call out to the booth lady.
Excuse me, ma'am, I have a question.
She turns.
Yes?
I ask something inane about the rules of ring toss. In my peripheral vision, I see Perry tiptoe into the booth. 4 seconds later, he leaps back.
I won! I won!
The booth lady spins around. She sees two Coke bottles with rubber rings around their necks. She looks shocked, then skeptical.
Now wait just a minute, kid. I won. Give me my panda. I didn't see.
That's your problem if you didn't see. That's not the rule. You have to see.
Where does it say you have to see? I want to talk to your supervisor. Get Mr. Busch Gardens himself down here. I'm taking this whole amusement park to court. What kind of a jip is this? I paid $1 to play this game, and that's an implied contract. You owe me a panda. I'm suing. My father is suing. You have exactly 3 seconds to get me my panda, which I won fair and fucking square.
Perry is doing what he loves, talking. He's doing what his father does, selling air. And the booth lady is doing what she hates, manning a booth at an amusement park. It's no contest. She doesn't want any trouble, and she doesn't need this headache. With a long stick, she snatches down the big panda and forks it over. It's nearly as tall as Perry. He grabs it like a giant chipwich, and we run off before she changes her mind. For the rest of the night, we're a threesome. Perry, me, and the panda. We bring the panda to the snack bar, into the boys' room, on the roller coaster. It's like we're babysitting a comatose 14-year-old. A real panda couldn't be more trouble. When the time comes to board the bus, we're both weary and glad to dump the panda in its own seat, which it fills. Its girth is as shocking as its height. I say, I hope Jamie appreciates this. Perry says, she's going to love it. A little girl sits behind us. She's 8 or 9. She can't take her eyes off the panda. She coos and pets its fur.
What a pretty panda. Where did you get it?
We won it.
What are you going to do with it?
I'm giving it to a friend. She asks to sit with the panda. She asks if she can cuddle it. I tell her to help herself. I hope Jamie likes the panda half as much as this girl does. Perry and I are hanging out in the barracks the next morning when Gabriel pokes his head in.
The man wants to see you.
What about? Gabriel shrugs. I walk slowly, taking my time. I stop at the door to Nick's office, and with a thin smile I remember, Nick the Dick. You'll be missed, Roddy. Nick is sitting behind his desk, leaning back in his tall, black leather chair.
Andre, come in, come in.
I sit in a wooden chair across from him. He clears his throat.
I understand, he says, that you were at Busch Gardens yesterday. Did you have fun?
I say nothing. He waits, then clears his throat again.
Well, I understand you came home with a very large panda.
I continue to stare straight ahead.
Anyway, he says, my daughter apparently has fallen in love with that panda.
I think of the little girl on the bus. Nick's daughter, of course. How could I have missed that?
She can't stop talking about it, Nick says. So here's the thing. I'd like to buy that panda from you.
Silence.
You hear me, Andre?
Silence.
Can you understand?
Silence.
Gabriel, why isn't Andre saying anything?
He's not speaking to you.
Since when?
Gabriel frowns.
Look, Nick says. Just tell me how much you want for it, Andre.
I don't move my eyes.
I know. Why don't you write down how much you want for it?
He slides a piece of paper toward me. I don't move.
How about if I give you $200?
Deep silence. Gabriel tells Nick that he'll talk to me later about the panda.
Yeah, Nick says. Okay, have a think about it, Andre.
You'll never believe this, I tell Perry at the barracks. He wanted the panda for his daughter. That little girl on the bus was Nick's daughter. You're kidding. And what did you say?
I said nothing.
What do you mean, nothing?
Vow of silence, remember?
Forever. Andre, you misplayed that. No, no, that's a miss. You've got to revisit this, quickly. Here's the play. You take the panda, you give it to Nick, and tell him you don't want his money. You just want an opportunity to succeed and get out of this place. You want wild cards, bids to tournaments, different rules to live by, better food, better everything. Above all, you don't want to go to school. This is your chance to break free. You've got real leverage now. I can't give that fucking guy my panda. I just can't. Besides, what about Jamie? We'll worry about Jamie later. This is your future we're talking about. You have to give that panda to Nick. We talk until long after lights out, arguing in heated whispers. Finally, Perry convinces me. So, he says, yawning, you're going to give it to him tomorrow. No. Bullshit. I'm going to his office right now. I'm going to let myself in with the master key, then put the panda on Nick's tall leather chair, ass up. The next morning, before breakfast, Gabriel comes for me again.
Office, on the double.
Nick is in his chair. The panda is now in the corner, leaning, staring into space. Nick looks at the panda, then me. He says,
"You don't talk. You wear makeup. You wear jeans in a tournament. You get me to invite your friend Perry to the tourney, even though he can't play. He can barely chew gum and walk at the same time. And that hair. Don't get me started on that hair. And now you give me something I ask for, but you break into my office in the middle of the night and put it ass up in my fucking chair? How the fuck did you get in my office? Jesus, boy, what is your problem?"
You want to know what my problem is? Even Nick is shocked by the sound of my voice. You are my fucking problem. You. And if you haven't figured that out, then you're stupider than you look. Do you have any idea what it's like here? What it's like to be 3,000 miles from home, living in this prison, waking up at 6:30, having 30 minutes to eat that shitty breakfast, getting on that broken-down bus, going to that lousy school for 4 hours, hurrying back, and having 30 minutes to eat more crap before going on the tennis court day after day after day? Do you? The only thing you have to look forward to, the only real fun you have every week, is Saturday night at the Bradenton Mall. And then that gets taken away. You took that from me. This place is hell, and I want to burn it down. Nick's eyes are wider than the panda's, but he's not angry or sad. He's mildly pleased, because this is the only language he understands. He reminds me of Pacino in Scarface when a woman tells him, "Who, why, when, and how I fuck is none of your business." And Pacino says, "Now you're talking to me, baby." Nick, I realize, likes it rough.
"Okay," he says. "You made your point. What do you want?"
I hear Perry's voice. "I want to quit school," I say. "I want to start doing correspondence school so I can work on my game full time. I want your help instead of the bullshit you've been giving me. I want wild cards, bids to tournaments. I want to take real steps toward turning pro." Of course, None of this is really what I want. It's what Perry tells me I want, and it's better than what I've got. Even as I demand it, I feel ambivalent. But Nick looks at Gabriel, and Gabriel looks at me, and the panda looks at all of us.
I'll think about it, Nick says.
Hours after Perry leaves for Vegas, Nick sends word via Gabriel that my first wild card will be the big tournament at La Quinta. Also, he's going to get me into the next Florida satellite. Furthermore, I'm to consider myself hereby dismissed and excused from Bradenton Academy. He'll set up a correspondence program of some sort when he gets around to it. Gabriel walks off, smirking. You won, kid. I watch everyone else board the bus for Bradenton Academy, and as it rumbles away, spewing black smoke, I sit on a bench, basking in the sunshine. I tell myself, you're 14 years old, and you never have to go to school again. From now on, every morning will feel like Christmas and the first day of summer vacation combined. A smile spreads across my face, my first in months. No more pencils, no more books, no more teachers' dirty looks. You're free, Andre. You'll never have to learn anything again. Chapter 7. I put in my earring and run down to the hard courts. The morning is mine, mine, and I spend it hitting balls. Hit harder. I hit for 2 hours, channeling my newfound freedom into every swing. I can feel the difference. The ball explodes off my racket. Nick appears, shaking his head.
I pity your next opponent, he says.
Meanwhile, back in Vegas, my mother begins correspondence school on my behalf. Her first actual correspondence is a letter to me, in which she says that her son might not go to college, but he's damn sure going to graduate high school. I write back and thank her for doing my homework and taking my tests. But when she earns the degree, I add, she can keep it. In March 1985, I fly to Los Angeles and stay with Philly, who's living in someone's guest cottage, giving tennis lessons, searching for what he wants to do with his life. He helps me train for La Quinta, one of the year's biggest tournaments. The guest cottage is tiny, smaller than our back room in Vegas, smaller than our rented Omni, but we don't mind. We're thrilled to be reunited, hopeful about my new direction. There's just one problem. We have no money. We subsist on baked potatoes and lentil soup. 3 times a day, we bake 2 potatoes and heat a can of generic lentil soup. Then we pour the soup over the potatoes and voila, breakfast, lunch, or dinner is served. The whole meal costs 89 cents and keeps hunger at bay for about 3 hours. The day before the tournament, we drive Philly's beat-up jalopy over to La Quinta. The car produces enormous clouds of black smoke. It feels like driving a portable summer storm. Maybe we should stick a potato in the tailpipe, I tell Philly. Our first stop is the grocery store. I stand before the bin of potatoes and my stomach rolls. I can't face another spud. I walk off, wander up and down the aisles, and find myself in the frozen food section. My eye lands on one particularly enticing treat, Oreo ice cream sandwiches. I reach for them like a sleepwalker. I take a box of ice cream sandwiches from the case and meet my brother in the express lane. Slipping behind him, I gently set the ice cream sandwiches on the conveyor belt. He looks down, then looks at me. We can't afford that. I'll have this instead of my potato. He picks up the box, looks at the price, lets out a low whistle. Andre, this costs as much as 10 potatoes. We can't. I know. Fuck. Walking back to the frozen food case, I think, I hate Philly. I love Philly. I hate potatoes. Woozy with hunger,
I go out and beat Broderick Dyke in the first round at La Quinta, 6-4, 6-4. In the second round, I beat Real Baxter, 6-2, 6-1. In the third round, I beat Russell Simpson, 6-3, 6-3. Then I win my first round in the main draw against John Austin, 6-4, 6-1. Down a break in the first set, I come storming back. I'm 15 years old, beating grown men, beating them senseless, churning my way through the ranks. Everywhere I walk, people are pointing at me, whispering, "There he is. That's the kid I was telling you about, the prodigy." It's the prettiest word I've ever heard applied to me. Prize money for reaching the second round at La Quinta is $2,600, but I'm an amateur, so I get nothing. Still, Philly learns that the tournament will reimburse players for expenses. We sit in his jalopy and make up an itemized list of imaginary expenses, our imaginary five-star hotel room, our imaginarily lavish restaurant meals. We think we're shrewd, because our expenses equal exactly $2,600. Philly and I have the balls to ask for so much because we're from Vegas. We spent our childhoods in casinos. We think we're born bluffers. We think we're high rollers. After all, we did learn to double down before we were potty trained. Recently, while walking through Caesars, Philly and I passed a slot machine just as it began to play that old Depression-era song, "We're in the Money." We knew the song from Pops, so we felt it was a sign. It didn't occur to us that the slot machine played that song all day long. We sat down at the nearest blackjack table and won. Now, with the same swagger born of naivete, I walk our list of expenses into the office of the tournament director, Charlie Passerell, while Philly waits in the car. Charlie is a former player. In fact, back in 1969, he played Pancho Gonzalez in the longest men's singles match ever at Wimbledon. Pancho is now my brother-in-law. He recently married Rita. Another sign that Philly and I are in the money. But the biggest sign of all, one of Charlie's oldest friends is Alan King, who hosted the very same Vegas tournament where I saw Caesar and Cleopatra and the wheelbarrow full of silver dollars, where I worked as a ball boy with Wendy, where I first stepped onto a professional tennis court in an official capacity. Signs, signs, everywhere signs. I place the list on Charlie's desk and stand back. "Huh," Charlie says, looking over the list. "Very interesting." "Sorry?" "Expenses don't usually work out so neat." I feel a hot flash. "Your expenses, Andre, are exactly the same amount as the prize money you'd be able to collect if you were a pro." Charlie looks at me over the top of his glasses. I feel my heart shrivel to the size of a lentil. I consider making a run for it. I imagine Philly and me living in that guest cottage for the rest of our lives. But Charlie suppresses a smile, reaches into a strong box, and removes a wad of bills. "Here's $2,000, kid. Don't grind me for the other 600." "Thank you, sir. Thank you very much." I run outside and dive into Philly's car. He peels out as if we've just held up the first bank of La Quinta. I count out $1,000 and throw it at my brother. "Your cut of the loot." "What? No. Andre, you worked hard for this, bro." "Are you kidding? We worked. Philly, I couldn't have done this without you. Impossible. We're in this together, man." In the back of our minds, we're both thinking of the morning I woke up with $300 on my chest. We're also thinking of all those nights, sitting in the ad-court-deuce court of our bedroom, sharing everything. He leans over while driving and gives me a hug. Then we talk about where we're going to eat dinner. We're drooling as we bandy names of restaurants about. In the end, we agree that this is a special occasion, a once-in-a-lifetime occasion, which calls for something truly fancy. Sizzler. "I can already taste that ribeye," Philly says.
I'm not going to bother with a plate. I'm going to just shove my head into the salad bar. They have an all-you-can-eat shrimp special. They're going to be sorry they ever came up with that idea.
You said it, bro.
We gnaw through the La Quinta sizzler, not leaving a single seed or crouton in our wake, then sit around and stare at the money we have left over. We line up the bills, stack them, stroke them. We talk about our new buddy, Benjamin Franklin. We're so drunk on calories, we break out the steam iron and run it lightly over each bill, gently smoothing out the wrinkles in Ben's face. Chapter 8. I continue to live and train at the Boletari Academy, with Nick as my coach and sometime travel companion, though he feels more like a sounding board, and, honestly, a friend. Our makeshift truce has turned into a surprisingly harmonious working relationship. Nick respects the way I stood up to him, and I respect him for being true to his word. We're working hard to achieve a common goal, to conquer the tennis world. I don't expect much from Nick in the way of X's and O's. I look to him for cooperation, not information. Meanwhile, he looks to me for headline-generating wins which help his academy. I don't pay him a salary, because I can't, but it's understood that when I turn pro, I'll give him bonuses based on what I earn. He considers this more than generous. Early spring, 1986. I tramp all over Florida, playing a series of satellite tournaments. Kissimmee, Miami, Sarasota, Tampa. After a year of working hard, focusing exclusively on tennis, I play well, making it to the fifth tournament of the series, the Masters. I reach the final and, though I lose, I'm entitled to a finalist check of $1,100. I want to take it. I yearn to take it. Philly and I sure could use the money. Still, if I take that check, I'm a professional tennis player forever. No turning back. I phone my father back in Vegas and ask him what I should do. My father says,
"What the hell do you mean? Take the money."
If I take the money, there's no turning back. I'm pro.
So?
If I cash this check, Pops, that's it. He acts as if we have a bad connection.
You've dropped out of school. You have an eighth grade education. What are your choices? What the hell else are you going to do? Be a doctor?
None of this comes as news, but I hate the way he puts it. I tell the tournament director I'll take the money. As the words leave my mouth, I feel a shelf of possibilities fall away. I don't know what those possibilities might be, but that's the point. I will never know. The man hands me a check, and as I walk out of his office, I feel as if I'm starting down a long, long road, one that seems to lead into a dark, ominous forest. It's April 29th, 1986, my 16th birthday. In disbelief, all day long, I tell myself, "You're a professional tennis player now. That's what you are. That's who you are." No matter how many times I say it, it just doesn't sound right. The one unequivocally good thing about my decision to turn pro is that my father sends Philly on the road with me full-time to help with the minutiae, the endless details and arrangements of being a pro, from renting cars to reserving hotel rooms to stringing rackets.
"You need him,"
my father says, but all three of us know that Philly and I need each other. The day after I turn pro, Philly gets a call from Nike. They want to meet with me about an endorsement deal. Philly and I meet the Nike man in Newport Beach at a restaurant called the Rusty Pelican. His name is Ian Hamilton. I call him Mr. Hamilton, but he says I should call him Ian. He smiles in a way that makes me trust him instantly. Philly, however, remains wary.
"Boys,"
Ian says,
"I think Andre has a very bright future."
"Thank you."
"I'd like Nike to be a part of that future, to be a partner in that future."
"Thank you."
I'd like to offer you a 2-year contract.
Thank you.
During which time Nike will provide all your gear and pay you $20,000.
For both years?
For each year.
Ah. Philly jumps in.
What would Andre have to do in exchange for this money?
Ian looks confused.
Well, he says, Andre would have to do what Andre has been doing, son. Keep being Andre, and wear Nike stuff.
Philly and I look at each other, two Vegas kids who still think they know how to bluff, but our poker faces are long gone. We left them back at Sizzler.
We can't believe this is happening, and we can't pretend to feel otherwise. At least Philly still has the presence of mind to ask Ian if we may be excused. We need a few moments in private to discuss his offer. We speed walk to the back of the rusty Pelican and dial my father from the payphone.
Pops, I whisper. Philly and I are here with the guy from Nike, and he's offering me $20,000. What do you think?
Ask for more money.
Really?
More money. More money.
He hangs up. Philly and I rehearse what we're going to say. I play me, he plays Ian. Men passing us on their way in and out of the men's room think we're doing a skit. At last, we walk casually back to the table. Philly spells out our counteroffer. More money. He looks grave. He looks, I can't help but notice, like my father.
Okay, Ian says. I think we can manage that. I have the budget for $25,000 for the second year. Deal?
We shake his hand. Then we all walk out of the rusty Pelican. Philly and I wait for Ian to drive off before jumping up and down, singing We're in the Money.
Can you believe this is happening?
No, Philly says. Honestly? No, I can't.
Can I drive back to L.A.?
No, your hands are shaking. You'll pile us straight into a median, and we can't have that.
You're worth 20 grand, bro.
And 25 next year. All the way back to Philly's place, item one on our agenda is what model of cool but cheap car we're going to buy. The main thing is to buy a car with a tailpipe that doesn't blow black clouds. Pulling up to Sizzler in a car that doesn't smoke, now that would be the height of luxury. My first tournament as a pro is in Schenectady, New York. I reach the final of the $100,000 tournament, then lose to Ramesh Krishnan, 6-2, 6-3. I don't feel bad, however. Krishnan is great, better than his ranking of 40-something, and I'm an unknown teenager, playing in the final of a fairly important tournament. It's that ultimate rarity, a painless loss. I feel nothing but pride. In fact, I feel a trace of hope, because I know I could have played better, and I know Krishnan knows. Next, I travel to Stratton Mountain, Vermont, where I beat Tim Mayotte, who's ranked number 12. In the quarterfinal, I play John McEnroe, which feels like I'm playing John Lennon. The man is a legend. I've grown up watching him, admiring him, though I've often rooted against him, because his arch-rival, Borg, was my idol. I'd love to beat Mac, but this is his first tournament after a brief hiatus. He's well-rested, raring to go, and he was recently ranked number 1 in the world. Moments before we take the court, I wonder why a player as polished and accomplished as Mac needs a hiatus. Then he shows me. He demonstrates the virtue of rest. He beats me soundly, 6-3, 6-3. During the loss, however, I managed to hit one atomic winner, a forehand return of Mac's serve that explodes past him. At the post-match news conference, Mac announces to reporters, I've played Becker, Connors, and Lendl, and no one ever hit a return that hard at me. I never even saw the ball. This one quote, this ringing endorsement of my game from a player of Mac's status, puts me on the national map. Newspapers write about me. Fans write to me. Philly suddenly finds himself deluged with requests for interviews. He giggles every time he fields another.
Nice to be popular, he says.
My ranking, meanwhile, keeps pace with my popularity. I go to my first U.S. Open in the late summer of 1986, feeling eager for the step up in competition. Then I see the New York skyline from the airplane window, and my eagerness evaporates. It's a beautiful sight, but intimidating for someone who grew up in the desert. So many people, so many dreams, so many opinions. Up close, at street level, New York is less intimidating than irritating. The nasty smells, the ear-splitting sounds, and the tipping. Raised in a house that depended on tips, I believe in tips. But in New York, the tip takes on a brand new dimension. It costs me $100 just to get from the airport to my hotel room. By the time I've greased the palm of the cabbie, the doorman, the bellhop, and the concierge, I'm tapped out. Also, I'm late for everything. I continually underestimate the time it takes to travel in New York from point A to point B. One day, right before the start of the tournament, I'm due to practice at 2 o'clock. I leave my hotel in what I think is plenty of time to reach the arena in Flushing Meadows. I board a charter bus outside the hotel, and by the time we navigate the Midtown gridlock and cross the Triborough, I'm horribly late. A woman tells me they've given away my court. I stand before her, pleading for another practice time.
Who are you?
I show her my credentials, flash a weak smile. Behind her is a chalkboard, covered with a sea of players' names, which she consults skeptically. I think of Mrs. G. She runs her fingers up and down the left column.
Okay, she says. 4 o'clock, court 8.
I peer at the name of the player I'll be practicing with.
I'm sorry, I can't practice with that guy. I'm possibly going to play that guy in the second round.
She consults the chalkboard again, sighing, annoyed. And now I wonder if Mrs. G has a long-lost sister. At least I'm no longer rocking a mohawk, which would make me even more offensive to this woman. On the other hand, my current hairstyle is only slightly less outrageous. A fluffy, spiky, two-toned mullet with black roots and frosted tips.
Okay, she says. Court 17, 5 o'clock, but you'll have to share with 3 other guys.
I tell Nick. It feels as if I'm in over my head in this town.
Nah, he says. You'll be fine.
The whole place looks a lot better from a distance. What doesn't? In the first round, I face Jeremy Bates from Great Britain. We're on a back court far from the crowds and the main action. I'm excited. I'm proud. Then I'm terrified. I feel as if it's the final Sunday of the tournament. My butterflies are flying in tight formation. Because it's a grand slam, the energy of the match is different from anything I've experienced. More frenetic. The play is moving at warp speed, a rhythm with which I'm unfamiliar. Plus, the day is windy, so points seem to be flying past like the gum wrappers and dust. I don't understand what's happening. This doesn't even feel like tennis. Bates isn't a better player than I, but he's playing better, because he came in knowing what to expect. He beats me in 4 sets, then looks up at my box where Philly is sitting with Nick, and shoves his fist into the crook of his arm, the international sign for "Up yours." Apparently, Bates and Nick have a history. I feel disappointed, slightly embarrassed, but I know that I wasn't prepared for my first U.S. Open or New York. I see a gap between where I am and where I need to be, and I feel reasonably confident that I can close that gap.
You're going to get better, Philly says, putting an arm around me. It's just a matter of time.
Thanks, I know. And I do know. I really do. But then I begin to lose. Not just lose, but lose badly, weakly,
miserably. In Memphis, I get knocked out in the first round. In Key Biscayne, the first round again. Philly, I say, what's going on? I have no clue out there. I feel like a hacker, a weekend player. I'm lost. The low point is at the Spectrum in Philadelphia. It's not a tennis facility, but a converted basketball arena, and barely that. Cavernous, poorly lit, it's got two tennis courts, side by side, and two matches taking place simultaneously. At the same moment I'm returning serve, somebody is returning serve in the next court, and if his serve goes wide at the same moment mine kicks, we both need to worry about colliding head on. My concentration is fragile enough without factoring in collisions with other players. I don't know yet how to tune out distractions. After one set, I can't think and can't hear anything but my own heartbeat. Also, my opponent is bad, which puts me at a disadvantage. I'm at my worst against lesser opponents. I play down to their level. I don't know how to maintain my game while adjusting for an opponent's, which feels like inhaling and exhaling at the same time. Against great players, I rise to the challenge. Against bad players, I press, which is the tennis term for not letting things flow. Pressing is one of the deadliest things you can do in tennis. Philly and I stagger back to Vegas. We're discouraged, but a more immediate problem is that we're broke. I've made no money in months, and with all the traveling and hotels, all the rental cars and restaurant meals, I've burned through nearly all my Nike money. From the airport, I drive straight to Perry's house. We hole up in his bedroom with a couple of sodas. As soon as his door is closed, I feel safer, saner. I notice that the walls are plastered with a few dozen more covers of Sports Illustrated. I study the faces of all the great athletes, and I tell Perry that I always believed I'd be a great athlete, whether I wanted to be one or not. I took it for granted. It was my life, and though I hadn't chosen it, my sole consolation was its certainty. At least fate has a structure. Now I don't know what the future holds. I'm good at one thing, but it looks as though I'm not as good at that one thing as I thought. Maybe I'm finished before I've started, in which case, what the hell are Philly and I going to do? I tell Perry that I want to be a normal 16-year-old, but my life keeps getting more abnormal. It's abnormal to be humiliated at the U.S. Open. It's abnormal to run around the Spectrum worrying about a head-on collision with some giant Russian. It's abnormal to be shunned in locker rooms. Why are you shunned? Because I'm 16 and in the top 100. Also, Nick isn't well-liked, and I'm associated with Nick. I have no friends, no allies. I have no girlfriend. Jamie and I are done. My latest crush, Jillian, another schoolmate of Perry's, doesn't return my calls. She wants a boyfriend who isn't on the road all the time. I can't blame her. Perry says, "I had no idea you were dealing with all this." But here's the topper, I tell him. I'm broke. What happened to the 20 grand from Nike? Travel, expenses. It's not just me on the road. It's Philly, Nick. It adds up. When you're not winning, it adds up faster. You can burn through 20 grand fast. Can you ask your father for a loan? No, absolutely not. Help from him comes with a cost. I'm trying to break free of him. Andre, everything will be fine. Yeah, sure. Really, it's about to get so much better. Before you know it, you're going to be winning again. Blink your eyes, and your face will be on one of these Sports Illustrated covers. Pfft. It will, I know it. And Jillian? Please. She's small time. You'll always have girl problems. That's the nature of the beast. But soon, the girl giving you problems will be Brooke Shields. Brooke Shields? Where do you get Brooke Shields? He laughs. I don't know. I just read about her in Time. She's graduating from Princeton. She's the most beautiful woman in the world. She's brilliant. She's famous. And someday you're going to date her. Don't get me wrong. Your life might never be normal. But soon, the abnormal will be cool. Buoyed by Perry, I go to Asia. I have just enough cash to get Philly and me there and back. I play the Japan Open, win a few matches, before falling to Andres Gomez in the quarters. Then I go to Seoul, where I reach the final. I lose, but my share of the prize money is $7,000, enough to fund another 3 months of searching for my game. As Philly and I land in Vegas, I feel relieved. I feel buoyant. Our father is meeting us at the airport, and I tell Philly as we walk through McCarran International Airport that I've made a momentous decision. I'm going to hug Pops.
Hug him? What for?
I feel good. I'm happy, damn it. Why not? I'm going to do it. You only live once. Our father is at the gate, wearing a baseball cap and sunglasses. I rush toward him, wrap my arms around him, and squeeze. He doesn't move. He stiffens. It feels like hugging the pilot. I release him and tell myself I'll never try that again. Philly and I go to Rome in May 1987. I'm in the main draw, so our rooms will be comped. We can upgrade from the dump Philly booked, which doesn't have TVs or shower curtains, to the swank Cavalieri, which sits atop a main hill overlooking the city. In our free days before the tournament, we get out and see the sights. We go to the Sistine Chapel and gaze at the frescoes of Christ handing St. Peter the keys to the kingdom of heaven. We stare at Michelangelo's ceiling and learn from the tour guide that he was a tormented perfectionist, eaten up with rage whenever he discovered that his work, or even materials on which he planned to work, had the tiniest flaws. We spend a day in Milan, stopping in churches and museums. We stand for half an hour before Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. We learn about da Vinci's notebooks, with their minute observations of the human form and their futuristic plans for helicopters and toilets. Both of us are floored that one man could have been so inspired. To be inspired, I tell Philly, that's the secret. The Italian Open is on red clay, a surface that feels unnatural to me. I've only played on green clay, which is sort of fast. Red clay, I tell Nick, is hot glue and wet tar laid across a bed of quicksand. You can't put a guy away on this red clay shit, I complain at our first practice. He smirks.
You're going to be fine, he says. You just have to get used to it. Don't be impatient. Don't try to finish every point.
I don't have the slightest idea what he means. I lose in the second round. We fly to Paris for the French Open. More red clay. I manage to win my first rounder, but get spanked in the second. Again, Philly and I try to see something of the city to improve ourselves. We go to the Louvre. The sheer number of paintings and sculptures daunts us. We don't know where to turn, how to stand. We can't comprehend all that we're seeing. We pass from room to room, dumbstruck. Then we come to a piece that we understand all too well. It's a painting from the Italian Renaissance, and it depicts a young man, naked, standing on a cliff. With one hand, he clutches a bare, breaking tree limb. With the other, he holds a woman and two infants. Wrapped around his neck is an old man, perhaps his father, who also grasps a sack of what looks like money. Below them lies an abyss strewn with the bodies of those who couldn't hold on. Everything depends on this one naked man's strength, his grip. The longer you look, I tell Philly, the tighter that old guy's arm around the hero's neck feels. Philly nods. He looks up at the man on the cliff and says softly, "Hang in there, bro." In June 1987, we go to Wimbledon. I'm scheduled to play a Frenchman, Henri Lecomte,
on Court 2, known as the Graveyard Court, because so many players have suffered fatal losses there. It's my first time at the most hallowed venue in tennis, and from the moment we arrive, I dislike it. I'm a sheltered teenager from Las Vegas with no education. I reject all that's alien, and London feels as alien as a place can be. The food, the buses, the venerable traditions. Even the grass of Wimbledon smells different from the grass back home, what little there is of it. More off-putting, Wimbledon officials appear to take a haughty, high-handed pleasure in telling players what to do and what not to do. I resent rules, but especially arbitrary rules. Why must I wear white? I don't want to wear white. Why should it matter to these people what I wear? Above all, I take offense at being barred and blocked and made to feel unwanted. I need to show a badge to get into the locker room, and not the main locker room at that. I'm playing in this tournament, but I'm treated as an intruder, not even allowed to practice on the courts where I'll be competing. I'm restricted to indoor courts up the street. Consequently, the first time I ever hit a ball on grass is the first time I play Wimbledon. And what a shock. The ball doesn't bounce right, doesn't bounce at all, because this grass isn't grass, but ice slathered with Vaseline. And I'm so afraid of slipping that I tiptoe. When I look around to see if the British fans have noticed my discomfort, I get a scare. They're right on top of me. The building is like a dollhouse. Add my name to the list of those who've expired on Graveyard Court. LeConte euthanizes me. I tell Nick that I'm never coming back. I'll hug my father again before I embrace Wimbledon. Still in a foul mood, I travel several weeks later to Washington, D.C. In the first round, playing Patrick Kunin, I come up empty, bone dry. After the long slog across Europe, I have nothing left. The travel, the losses, the stress, it's all sapped me. Plus, the day is oppressively hot, and I'm not physically fit. I'm wholly unprepared, so I become unpresent. When we're tied at one set apiece, I leave the court, mentally. My mind departs my body and goes floating out of the arena. I'm long gone when the third set starts. I lose 6-0. I walk to the net and shake Kunin's hand. He says something, but I can't see or hear him. He's a blob of energy at the end of a tube. I grab my tennis bag and stumble out of the arena. I walk across the street, into Rock Creek Park, into some woods, and when I feel sure no one is around, I berate the trees. I can't take this shit anymore! I'm fucking done! I quit! I keep walking, walking, until I come to a clearing, where I find myself surrounded by a group of homeless men. Some are sitting on the ground, some are stretched out on logs, sleeping. Two are playing cards. They all look like trolls in a fairy tale. I walk up to one who seems fairly alert. I unzip my bag and remove several Prince rackets.
Here, man, you want these? Do you? Because I don't have any use for them anymore.
The man isn't sure what's happening, but he's pretty confident that he's finally met someone crazier than himself. His buddies shuffle over, and I tell them,
"Gather round, fellows, gather round. It might be 100 degrees in the shade, but it's Christmas Eve.